I thought I'd leave a little bit of time for questions or comments now.
Well, we hear about nirvana, and we hear about liberation, and we hear about the word that just escaped me.
Enlightenment? Enlightenment?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so we hear about nirvana, liberation, and enlightenment, and are all these the same? You know, these words are used to have slightly different meanings in different contexts. Okay? Usually, when I refer to enlightenment, I'm referring to Buddhahood. And when I refer to nirvana, referring to the state of an arhat, somebody who's free of cyclic existence, which is not exactly the same as Buddhahood. Okay? The arhats have eliminated the afflictive obscurations, the ignorance, afflictions, and karma that cause rebirth and cyclic existence. But the Buddhas have also eliminated the stains on the mind that prevent them from all, you know, knowing all phenomena. So the enlightenment of the Buddha is higher, okay, than the liberation of an arhat. Okay, that's how I use the words generally. But, yeah, we also talk of non-abiding nirvana, in which, and that non-abiding nirvana is the same thing as the enlightenment of the Buddha. Because that non-abiding nirvana doesn't abide in samsara, and it doesn't abide in the state of peace of an arhat. Because an arhat has liberated their own mind, but they don't have the full capacities to be of the highest benefit to all sentient beings. So the arhats still have some, it's called cognitive obscurations on their minds, the stains of the afflictions. So a Buddha has eliminated those. Okay, so when we talk about non-abiding nirvana, that person doesn't abide in samsara, doesn't abide in that self-complacent nirvana of an arhat. Yeah. So that's another way that you use the word nirvana. Then sometimes when we're talking about three vehicles, the vehicle of the hearer, of the solitary realizer, and of the bodhisattva, then, because the hearer, those are beings who hear the teachings and practice, the solitary realizers attain nirvana, you know, in a solitary mode. I'm just giving very cursory explanations of these terms, not at all precise. But in any case, they attain arhatship. When you study about that, it's called the enlightenment of a hearer, the enlightenment of a solitary realizer, and the enlightenment of a bodhisattva. But these three enlightenments are not exactly the same. Okay? So, you know, in that context, when you're studying the three vehicles in that way, then the word enlightenment can have different meanings. Okay? So you have to kind of listen for the context.
And I had thought, when I heard about the solitary realizer, I had thought of them as being the Theravadins, and the Bodhisattvas would be the Mahayanas.
Okay, so you had thought of the solitary realizers as being the Theravadas and the Bodhisattvas as being the Mahayanas. These terms are, I like, really, really confusing, okay? Because we can discriminate people as like Theravada and Mahayana in different ways. One way is according to their philosophical tenets. Another way is according to their motivation. Okay? So the hearers, yeah, and the solitary realizers, they're both aiming for nirvana. Yeah? So somebody... Oh, this gets very complicated. Also because the Tibetans don't use the term Theravada. They use another word that is very... that I don't like. Yeah. Yeah, they use the term Hinayana, which does not apply to the Theravada. Okay? Hinayana and Theravada are different. So it gets kind of complicated. Best thing, let's just make it kind of simple. It depends on somebody's aspiration. Mm-hmm. Okay? So by and large, in the Theravada tradition, people aspire for their own liberation. But I wouldn't say that everybody does, because I think there's some people there that have very much an altruistic intention. And there may be also bodhisattvas who manifest as Theravada teachers. Yeah? Okay. To be a Mahayanist, you aspire for the enlightenment of a Buddha. But not everybody who practices in a Mahayana tradition necessarily has that aspiration. Some people, basically, when they come down to it, are aspiring for their own liberation. Okay? So it doesn't really matter what you call yourself. It's, you know, one way to discriminate these is based on your motivation. And that's going to vary, you know, according to the individual in each tradition, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your teaching. You mentioned non-anger as kind of property of the third noble truth.
Mm-hmm.
What would you recommend for those of us who have difficulty with that, and who, for example, in the Hebrew Bible, there's the mm-hmm. notion of righteous anger.
Mm.
And anger that's appropriate because it's caused by injustice.
Mm-hmm.
What would you recommend for that sort of a response to anger that is caused by injustice?
Okay. So what would I recommend if I'm advocating the elimination of all anger? What would I recommend as a replacement for righteous anger that comes up in the face of injustice? Compassion. Okay. Compassion doesn't mean, you know, we have to understand compassion properly, because we often hear compassion and we think icky gooey, kind of, you know, it's okay, dear, don't worry, you know. That's not what we're talking about. Okay. I think compassion is very powerful, because compassion cares for everybody in the situation. Whereas righteous anger has a side I'm for and a side I'm against. And as soon as our mind gets blinded by that bias, our ability to really be a benefit in the situation gets blinded. Because we become very partial. I'm for this side and I'm against this side. So then everything this side does is automatically good. Everything that side does is automatically bad. You know, we become very blinded. We can't see the nuances of things. Yeah. Whereas if we have compassion and we see that this is a predicament and everybody is suffering and miserable in it, yeah, then our mind isn't biased like that. Our mind isn't revved up. We have the ability to look at it and say, well, how can we deal in this situation? That's, you know, that can create, you know, some possibility for resolution without further conflict. You know, because the problem with righteous anger is that it very often seeks violent, drastic means as a way to end injustice. Yeah? The difficulty with violent, drastic means are that as soon as you smash the person that is the perpetrator of the harm, that perpetrator becomes a victim and becomes miserable. You know, nobody likes getting beaten up, and they're not going to turn around and look at the people who beat them up and say, I love you. So what's happening is that now the perpetrator is going to have a lot of angry, a lot of misery. You know, what you consider the right side is victorious, but the other people are miserable. And as long as they're miserable, then they're going to eventually, you know, fight back. Yeah? So that's the problem with that kind of outlook. you know, and that kind of action. Whereas if we try and look at a situation and think, okay, what is a way that it won't resolve it perfectly for everybody, but maybe there's some chance that different people can have some of their needs met and at least learn to get along. Okay. Yeah.
Quick note before my question or comment on what you just said. And you just said, I don't know if it's in Ecclesiastes or Proverbs, but there's a verse that says, "Don't let the sun go down on your wrath." I found that powerful at one point in my life. I mean, where is that defined for someone to get on? Anyway, my question is, can you explain the fourth truth in terms of the higher training?
Okay. I just want to repeat your comment for the taking card of it. There's a Bible verse about don't let the sun go down on your wrath, and that you found that helpful. I think that's quite beautiful. Yeah. So developing some kind of forgiveness, letting go of our own anger so it doesn't perpetuate, you know, in our own mind, let alone throughout a community and throughout generations. And then your question was, could I explain the Fourth Noble Truth in terms of the three higher trainings? Yeah. So actually, the Eightfold Noble Path can be subsumed within the three higher trainings. Okay? So if we're practicing the higher training of ethical conduct, then it's going to be right livelihood, right action, and right speech. You know? And particular in the higher training of ethical conduct, it's taking precepts where you make a conscious determination not to do certain actions. Then under right concentration, then we have right mindfulness and right concentration of the Eightfold Path. Sometimes they put right effort in there too, but then effort kind of applies to all of them. Yeah. So right concentration here is, really learning the meditative practice and how to control your mind. And then the third higher training of wisdom, that would be the right view and the right intention. So having the wisdom that understands not only the ultimate reality, but also the conventional functionings and conventional nature of things. Okay. Those are all very big topics. Yeah. Okay. So let's just sit quietly then for a couple of minutes and then dedicate.